This episode is brought to you by Seems Easy Record Sleeve Repair Strips. If you collect used records, you need some Seems Easy strips handy for record sleeve repair. They're super easy to use and repair those seam splits to make them like new.
Ask your record store for Seems Easy or go to SeemsEasy.com.
Seems Easy with two Z's. SeemsEasy.com. And now, on with the show. Hey everyone, it's Nate. Welcome to episode 378 of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds, and we've got a very knowledgeable, very compelling guest today, Mr. John Robb, who you may know from his long history of music and media journalism, and who's written a few books, including a brand new one on the history of goth. The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth is now available for pre-order. Google it up, get one on the way. There's even signed and personalized copies at louderthanwar.com. Now, in this conversation, John takes us through the fascinating history of goth culture, music, vinyl, artists, and even his own history with the likes of Nirvana, Fugazi, and more. I mean, the man is an absolutely compelling speaker. No wonder he's been featured on multiple TED Talks. That's right, Google him up. And again, The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth is a riveting read. So do yourself a favor and grab a copy. And by the way, I have a mucho extended version of this interview with John available only to Patreon supporters at patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and you get extra content, extra interviews, commercial-free, and high audio resolution for your earholes. So please, head up there now, patreon.com/vinylguide. Help support the show and get all the extras, including an extended interview with John Robb. Alrighty, that's it for the upfronts. Let's get into our conversation and learn about the history of goth with John Robb. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we are welcoming founder and editor-in-chief of Louder Than War, founder and head provocateur of The Membranes, Gold Blade, and several other musical projects, as well as author of several books, including the brand new book, The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth, Mr. John Robb. Welcome to the show, sir.
Yes. Well, is it good morning or good evening? I'm completely confused.
It's good evening. It's good evening.
Good
evening. Yes. It's nighttime here. We've got the wine. You guys have the coffee, right?
Yeah.
Look, in this book, The History of Goth, it seems like the history of goth is really the history. It's so intertwined with the history of rock and roll. I mean, after reading the book, I found it quite hard to think of artists who haven't had a minor key tune or fall into the realm of goth at some point or some song or another. Is that fair? Am I missing something there?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the crux of the book. In fact, it's actually stretched out further than that, because with goth, it's not like it's not like a momentary kind of youth culture that was here and gone. It's actually, when you actually look at it and unpack it, this is something that goes back centuries in a way. And I like the idea that every generation had to deal with its blues. So whether it was romantic poets, whether it was Lord Byron and that incredible weekend in Geneva when him and Shelley and Mary Shelley, they're writing Dracula and Frankenstein in a 48-hour period, which has got to be one of the most creative weekends in history. And all those people sort of dealing with those themes as sex and death and nature in the romantic poet, kind of seeing people like William Blake and, you know, proto-romantic sort of figure, whatever. And all those sort of things. So every generation was dealing with it in its own way, of the technology of the time. So whether it was getting a quill and writing an incredible novel or writing an incredible piece of poetry, or it was designing a cathedral in the Middle Ages, or whether it was kind of dabbling in the occult, as like people, Aleister Crowley, who's a very kind of proto-Gothic figure in a sense, or in my period, it was dealing with music because it's so central to our culture. Those feelings and that fascination with melancholy, which is not, it's not immersive. It's not like everyone's moping around. It's actually quite a fascinating thing to deal with. But it was crisscrossed with music and electric musical culture, because that was our art culture of the time. Whereas now, interestingly, the goth scene plays out on TikTok and Instagram, and you get a lot of TikTok and Instagram and YouTube influencers. You don't really do the music. They do the style of clothes and the atmosphere, but in their technology of their time. And I think that's perfectly valid. I find it quite fascinating that the goth vibe exists in lots of different portals.
No, absolutely. I mean, and it's, again, we think of it a lot as music because, well, that's kind of our world in many ways. But movies, architecture, fashion, and probably a dozen other things that I'm not naming off right now. But your book, again, just for folks to follow us along, you lead through, it's not just goth music, but the history of actually the Visigoths, taking us through into modern day and where even the term of goth comes from. Can you summarize in just a few moments the history of goth?
I think a book has to start somewhere, and I thought it'd be pretty cool to start with the sacking of Rome in 411 by the Visigoths, because I think that's probably the first time that word had entered the parlance, you know. I mean, who know what they call themselves? Would they even call themselves goth? But this idea that classical architecture and the classical notion of Europe was destroyed by these kind of barbarian hordes is something that I think is very much part of the European psyche, you know, to this day. And so when the Germans were building their cathedrals in the 13th to 14th century, they were sneered at for not building them in the classical style. They were Gothic. They weren't proper cathedrals. They didn't have the artfulness and the classical style of Rome or Athens. But they turned that round, didn't they? They said, no, this is our art and this is our way of doing it. And so Gothic became an equally, you know, Gothic cathedrals are incredible buildings, aren't they? And they had their own aesthetic. And then art and painting and literature arrived to match the architecture, which is an incredible kind of move, isn't it? And it was almost like the culture of Europe and move beyond the Mediterranean and into the more damper inclement parts of Europe, you know. So, and all that kind of does play into the Gothic theme, because when it did arrive as a culture, it was kind of sniffed at as not being proper culture, you know, like the proper, like post-punk, which I love as well, of course, but that's always been looked on as being the proper culture that came out of punk. You know, this is the art. But I was trying to say that goth had an incredible art as well. So groups like Bauhaus, which always got terrible reviews at the time, and they're looked on as being like chancers, but they made art rock equal to the greatest art rock ever. You know, every song they do is completely different from every other song. And there's a massive artfulness to what they do and an art school kind of attitude to what they do. And across all those kind of bands, and I don't think people really, apart from people in the scene, obviously people in the scene knew all this, but people on the outside of the scene have always sort of looked on it as being like a fancy dress parade and not really taking the music that seriously. So someone like Adam Ant, you know, who would be looked on as being an early 80s pop star, surely his music can't be that great. But his first album is very dark, very kind of odd, off-kilter record, which is an influence on the goth scene. And his second album, his massive, huge Kings of Wild Frontier, number one for 14 weeks album, is actually a really bizarre record. It's a fantastic piece of art rock. And then he becomes a portal to goth, because he's not goth at that point. But for a lot of young kids who are 10 or 11 buying that record, it's, you know, those records that open the door. Uh-huh. And you think, you unpack them as a kid and you think, God, there's all this other stuff out here. Like Bowie had done with us in the 70s, you know, Bowie's interviews, they were like lessons in culture. I mean, you're reading about William Burroughs when you were 12 and going, who's he going on about? I mean, you couldn't Google it. You had to go and like dredge around libraries to work it out. So Bowie would turn you on to music and books and culture deliberately as well, you know. And I think that's important. That was important for punk, post-punk and goth, you know, what Bowie was talking about.
The one thing that's always struck me, and with goth music, but also even just architecture, seeing like a goth church or a building constructed with that, I always, it made me feel smaller, in as if I'm part of a larger universe. Like if you ever want to be brought right back down, you know, go into a Gothic cathedral and you will feel like, wow, there is a much wider world around here. And I kind of feel the same when I listen to music that's typically termed as goth. It's like I feel like I'm connected to others. I'm part of a larger scene. And I don't know if that's a characteristic of goth or if that's just my personal reaction, but that's kind of how these things that are termed goth tend to impact me personally.
I think all music cultures are like that, aren't they? Because basically we are tribal creatures. We're still living in caves, but our caves are like sonic caves or digital caves now, aren't they? So, and I've always really liked the idea that your personal sort of cultural cave isn't necessarily people in your town. Like nowadays, your gang, and this goes on a lot in gaming, is people all over the world, isn't it? You become part of a people have a shared interest in something culturally with somebody in Buenos Aires, someone in the middle of Africa in Tokyo, somebody in Sydney. You know, it's that's your gang. You never meet them, but they're in your gang. So, and pop culture was doing that in a sense. So, in a way, what goth was, and it wasn't called goth initially, it was alternative culture. And that's what everyone called it. And goth was a retrospective term that was put onto the scene. That's why all the bands hate the term, which is another interesting idiosyncrasy with goth. But they were always in really weird small towns, all these clubs where you would get beaten up for looking slightly weird. So when you were punk kids, were always getting beaten up by like people twice their age, which seemed like incredible bullying. You know, England was violent in the 70s. So birds of a feather were flocking together for safety. You know, it was safety in numbers. And these sort of little clubs where they play alternative music, you could dress up and you were free to be yourselves, eventually became this network of goth clubs. And goth was very much played out in clubs and dance floors. I mean, it was a live culture as well. But whereas punk was all just about live, it was very few punk clubs. Goth was loads of clubs everywhere. And the dance floor was key. So the goth bands had to make records that were good on the dance floor. And I think this is another interesting thing that people don't really recognise so much, is the massive influence of black music in goth as well. And the groove, you know, so disco, dub, funk are all really important parts of goth music, whereas punk had been, and it's great, but it's very claustrophobic music about energy. You know, you got off from the energy of punk. But goth is about the groove and the space and the technology that's coming in as well. So it was actually sonically quite a big shift in the 3 years of being seen since punk into what goth was.
Now, going into writing this book, did you feel that the topic of goth, there wasn't enough conversation about it?
Yeah, I just wanted to unpack it because I think I've done quite a few interviews, and we're obviously not with music heads like you, but with, you know, like local radios or just more mainstream interviews. Mm. And people see goth as black hair and black lipstick, and they don't see anything else. They just see it as that, you know. And I wanted to unpack it and explain there's way more going on here than that, you know. I mean, black hair, black lipstick, of course, is a big part of it. But you know, the music was very diverse. The culture was very diverse. And also, it's not just the music. It's, I mean, by putting all the romantic poets in there, that's not like a fallacy. I mean, goths read, you know, it's a culture. It's one of the rare cultures that it's about culture. You know, I mean, goths read books, you know, they watch films. And it's interesting that goth is such a big influence on a lot of modern literature and films as well, and gaming. And it's because it's more of a feeling, it can adopt to any other kind of culture and fit to other kind of things as well. But I also wanted to draw that line between Lord Byron and, say, someone like Nick Cave. They're almost equivalents of each other in different time zones. You know, Nick Cave is very poetic. He is like, he sort of represents that kind of, like that thing of Lord Byron was a very dashing kind of figure, and Nick Cave is as well, you know. But Nick Cave, bizarrely, he's had this longevity that Lord Byron never got, you know, at the time. You never think of Nick Cave having this, becoming the elder statesman of music culture.
I don't think he would have expected to become the elder statesman either. So,
but a brilliant elder statesman. He's actually come into his own over 60, you know, with his, you know, when he does the red right hand thing, he's actually really good. He's got an empathy, and it's the Nick Cave of now is a far more fascinating individual than the spiky Nick Cave young. But he's necessarily spiky, because I think when you're 20 to find your space in culture, you really have to kick against the pricks, but literally to find your kind of space. Yeah.
So the book, again, it starts off kind of telling a bit of the backstory. And you mentioned some of the Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, was it Edgar Allan Poe as well? There was that weekend where they got together and they, you know, we could only assume that they shared information, philosophized. And that is kind of almost the big bang of the modern goth culture, and actually a lot of music and entertainment culture as well. When it comes to more modern music, where do you think the early glimmers of goth started showing up?
There's hints of it. I mean, in post-war rock and roll culture, in the 50s, it was dark records. There was death rock. They were called death rock records then, which is the American term for goth. But there was, you know, like the girl group's songs about the boyfriend who died in a motorbike crash, or, You know, so there were dark side, and Link Wray, of course, you know, number one in America, wasn't a cult figure, he's mainstream, you know, and mm-hmm. his records had a sort of bubblegum darkness to them. And then the 60s is there as well. I mean, Paint It Black, perfect title, you know, it's in there, you know, there's a melancholic feel to that as well. But the first band that really coalesced all these themes is The Doors. And they're the first band to actually be called Gothic. So their first gig in New York City in 1967, the reviewer describes them as a Gothic rock band, which is so fitting, isn't it? I mean, I think mm-hmm. they probably are the key influence on so much of what came afterwards. Jim Morrison's baritone voice, his persona, his love of romantic poetry. I mean, he could quote chunks of romantic poetry. People, didn't he have that trick where people could say, shout a line of a book out of you know, that old romantic literature, and he would know what the book was. Man, I'm amazed he could actually do that, because he always seemed like he was just drunk all the time. where did he even get the time to read all these books?
Yeah.
And also his image as well, you know, he's dressing in black with the leather. It's totally the goth prototype. But what was interesting, and you grew up in America where The Doors are always a huge band, you know, every album's number one, but in the UK, they're a bit more of a cult band. So they're kind of known on a cultural level. I knew about them from Hippie Mates, but they only had 1.5 hits in England, you know, so it's like one got to 20 and one got to 40. So they're fringe here. But when Apocalypse Now came out in 79, that's when The Doors got big in England, you know, because there was that film, it's the greatest psychedelic film ever made. And The Doors are so entwined in it, and it's such a perfect vehicle for The Doors. And the scene at the end where they have the song, mm-hmm. with the napalm in the forest was mind-blowing. And I think a lot of people coming out of punk and post-punk, because we're year zero in punk, where you weren't allowed to listen to anything from the 60s, lasted about, I don't know, 3 months. Then everyone went on this massive investigation of all the stuff. You know, what was going on before? There must be good stuff. And that, and Apocalypse Now sort of arrived at the same time, and it was like, then you heard, people heard The Doors, and The Doors made complete sense at that time in England, 79. And I think they became, they were retrospective, but also they were current, and they became a massive influence on quite a few people in that post-punk period, along with the newer bands as well. So I think they're really, really key to it. But then the other keys that are really important is glam rock, and Bowie and Mark Bolan as well, very, very key to it. And I think, like we talked about before, you know, David Bowie's checklist of culture to go and listen to, and his records, you know, that kind of sci-fi darkness, and also that shape-shifting image thing that he had as well, that is really key. And I think Mark Bolan, just because he made amazing records that we all completely loved, you know, that's all in it. So it's kind of glam rock on The Doors. And a lot of goth was kind of a dark glam as well.
I guess I'm trying to consider, like, the characteristics of prototypical goth song. There'd need to be darkness. There'd be some melancholic, perhaps some macabre thinking in it, perhaps in a minor key. What do you think are the ingredients for a goth track?
I think if you look at the most archetype goth song, which whether they like it or not, is going to be Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus. I think it's all in there, isn't it? Because I mean, that song on its own is a fascinating story. That band's first rehearsal, they wrote that song. I mean, imagine most people's first rehearsal, they're still trying to work out who the bass player is going to be.
Well, that could take quite a while, as you may know from The Membranes.
Yeah, it's a journey that never actually ends, but they seem to arrive fully formed, like they were cadavers getting out of coffins or something. So they talk about, they wrote this 8-minute piece of music. It doesn't sound like anything else ever. I can't think of anything really sound like that before. And it's got a dark, and it's dark, and it's melancholic, but it's also kind of slyly quite funny as well, you know. So there's always a dash of humour in there. It's poetic, minimalism poetic, because minimalism is quite key in goth as well. You don't need to say everything in 600 words if you can say it in 10, which is, you know, what the Stooges did to The Doors, and they kind of reducted The Doors. All Jim Morrison's poetry, and I think Jim Morrison does write great lyrics, but Iggy managed to crunch it all down to two words, no fun, which is all you need to know in a brattish rock and roll anthem. It's the perfect thing. I'm having no fun, I'm bored. It's perfect, isn't it? So there was a minimalism at play in goth as well. And the sense of space that song has as well, a lot of goth had space in it. You know, it wasn't filling everything up all the time. So Bela Lugosi has, and I think a lot of people got that from Joy Division and Martin Hannett's insanely brilliant production of Joy Division, which was mind-boggling at the time. You know, nothing, you never heard anything like that, you know, and that was about space and texture and nuance, and all the instruments sounded different. I think another key was the placing of the instruments. Everybody played lead. This was a period when bass guitars were in the background. They played the melody lines, you know. So in Bela Lugosi, the bass is really important. You could dance to it. It's got that great 4/4 kick drum. Mix in with the bossa nova drumming. It's got a bossa nova beat, but it's instantly your head's going like that. You know, it's like a danceable thing. The baritone vocal, the Bowie influence, it's all in there. It is completely the art of darkness.
There'd have to be a certain tempo or an ideal tempo for goth music. You can't have speed goth necessarily, or maybe you can. I don't know. But it has to be kind of in that danceable range that's not too far outside the capabilities of people.
Yeah, but it's always the groove is in there. I mean, yeah, there will be examples and people listen to this now and go, yeah, but what about this one? You know, so there's always people who kind of break the mold, but that's part of it as well. You have to have a mold that gets broken. So the groove is important, and Bela Lugosi has the groove because he's got the 4-to-the-floor kick drum, which is basic dance music, you know, which nowadays every record, I mean, they didn't invent it, Bauhaus, but every record does 4-to-the-floor, you know, because it's the most simplistic way of getting people to dance. And it's great. It's just a kick drum and it's perfect. Yeah. But loads of goth records have that, but they all have a certain kind of groove to them. And goth, as you're saying, goth isn't fast. It's more about the groove and the feel.
But yeah, I guess in just after thinking about what you were saying there, I mean, we could also think of examples like Skinny Puppy or other bands who go much faster. I would say even maybe Front 242 with, you know, a lot of the industrial bands, you know, those are heavy goth leanings, but a much faster tempo.
Yeah, I think because by then it was kind of changing. And I think maybe the type of drugs people are taking changed things. So maybe people are taking faster drugs and it all sped up again. But I do write about the industrial scene in the book because that's a fascinating story in its own. And because when you talk about bands like Skinny Puppy or Front 242, that's such a long journey for an industrial starter. So when you get the beginnings of industrial music with Throbbing Gristle and the people they're writing to, you know, because it was all done by this weird mail art where they're sending like this kind of completely offensive literature to each other with letters. And they kind of make this music, which is not formed at all. It's quite avant-garde. And then somehow you sort of crisscross the rock music and it ends up with this kind of sound, this kind of heavily compressed, powerful dance music, which, you know, so bands like Ministry or whatever, there's a goth influence there, but they're not goth, but they're sort of somehow, if they wanted to be goth, they'd very easily be goth, but they feel slightly different, don't they? But they look goth. They feel goth. They taste goth.
Well, I think if you take something early Ministry, Twitch or something like that, I think that fits very solidly into the goth sphere, at least in my...
Being the goth clubs, but I don't think they were ever considered a goth band. Like Nine Inch Nails are the same, aren't they? I mean, goths like Nine Inch Nails, and Nine Inch Nails look and sound like a goth band, but I don't often see them termed as being goth. Every now and then, Rolling Stone will do their top 50 goth records. They might be in that. But generally, they were never considered part of that kind of scene. But they're a parallel. It's another convergent evolution, isn't it?
Yeah. And I also started thinking a little bit more about the geography of goth, because it seems that a majority of artists we consider goth, are from the UK, Berlin, and Europe. There are some from America, but it seems that there's a significant majority that are from the UK and Europe. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
It was very much driven by the UK. I think it's part of the UK's endless fascination with making culture, isn't it? And, you know, the clothes and music combination is a very British thing. Of course, it goes on in other places, but it goes on. It's very intense here and it's very important here. You know, what you wore was as important as the music, which in pop culture totally coalesced in all these different little scenes that either we started here or were driven here or were more formed here, you know. So there may be ideas coming in from America, but they got to change something quite differently. You can see that punk, can't you? I mean, punk was going on in CBGBs in New York and the Ramones, but but when you get to Britain, it's the Sex Pistols, which was quite a different thing from the Ramones, isn't it? There's a whole package around that. There's the clothes, the music, the politics, the culture is very intense, which is a very British thing. Whereas the Ramones, and I love the Ramones, but the Ramones were almost bubblegum. You know, it was comic strip, which is great. But the Pistols had about another 20 things going on in that thing. And it's the same with Goth as well. It was, there was a lot of layers to it, which I don't know why we do it. Why don't we just go and have fun? You know, in America, you could just put your sneakers on and a baseball top and go and party. But here, you have to work out what top you're going to wear for about 3 weeks.
Also, you know, again, thinking through the geographies here, there are no Gothic cathedrals in the U.S. The architecture and influence really isn't prevalent. I mean, you know, there's a thousand more years in UK and Europe than there is in the US. So that makes sense to me. And the Ramones are about minimalism. Everyone wears the same thing. And yeah, it is much closer to the Archies than it is, you know.
Yeah, which is great. I love the bubblegum element of the Ramones. Yeah. They turned bubblegum into an art form. We're a bit like another key band in the goth scene in England who weren't actually a goth band at all, the Cramps, you know, who embraced kind of kitsch and sort of trash and made it seem like high art, which was quite brilliant. I know people have done that before, but it's very much part of their thing. But the Cramps are huge in goth clubs in England. You go to a goth club and you hear them five times in a night. I mean, people love the Cramps. I mean, they didn't form as goth bands. I mean, the Cramps are a one-off and they're not a psychobilly band. They call themselves psychobilly. There was other psychobilly bands afterwards, and psychobilly became a scene in England, but the Cramps don't even fit into their own scene. I mean, they're actually, the more you think about the Cramps, the more you realise that they were a psychedelic band whose influence was backwards rockabilly records, you know, the press 50 of them. But somehow they turned that into a psychedelic music, but with a post-punk kind of knowingness. So they didn't seem like a 60s psychedelic band. They seemed like a psychedelic band from that now, from that moment. And their dark freakishness. See, thing is, people in America knew they were sort of kitschy and playing it for a laugh quite a lot of the time. But we didn't get that in England. When the first Cramps records came out, we thought they were deadly serious. We looked at pictures of Brian Gregory and thought, is he alive? He looked like a corpse. Because it wasn't like, you couldn't Google it. You couldn't go look up an interview. There was no interviews. They just looked like incredibly freakish, incredibly glamorously beautiful, and totally bizarre and scary. And the music was the same. You couldn't work out if they'd been serious or not. They just felt serious to us. They felt dark and dangerous.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Because, yeah, I always thought of psychobilly as that is a U.S. art form in my mind. Because, you know, you have the hillbillies, you have the garage rock and the psych. I guess the democratization of instruments and recording equipment that just allowed people to be creative very quickly at a very early stage in their ability to master their instruments. So there's a lot of music that's there just based on the feeling and the emotion and of people just coming to grips with the ability to form enough chords for a song.
Yeah, and I've always really loved that. I think, you know, music that captures that moment when people are doing this subconsciously, making music. They're not thinking about it too hard. It's just coming out, often makes the greatest music. Well, obviously the Cramps, they were smart. They were actually working out what they were doing, though. There was a concept to the Cramps, I think, before they'd even started playing their instruments. And it's quite interesting when you look at their backstory, you know, and they went to that psychedelic college in Sacramento where for a course they were doing that book about magic mushrooms, you know, being God and things. And there's an artfulness about them. You know, they're very, very intelligent people, Lux and Ivy. And I really like the story. I think it's a beautiful story. It's a love story, isn't it? I mean, for a band that freakish and that out there, there's actually the core of it is this amazing love story. You know, it's that which rock and roll is rare, isn't it? You know, most people get divorced after a year, and the actual core of the Cramps is a beautifully romantic story of a group that's pretty out there. But in the end, you know, they become more show busy and more kitschy, which is great. They were good at that. But that early period and the impact they had, I'll always love that idea that you just looked at the four pictures you had of them and tried to work out, are these people real or not?
Yeah, well, they would bring someone in the band like Kid Congo Powers, who really had probably been playing his instrument for about a year or two by that point. And the attitude was the most important thing. They could train for skill or they could learn some songs. But to get considered to go through the door, you had to have the attitude and be able to emote. And they kept it pure for, I would say that the majority of their creative life was based on that impulsive moment.
they had that thing, didn't they, where you have a concept, you don't stray from the concept. So, you know, the latter records, it's still, they're, you know that there's an element of humor to them, but they're still within the parameters what the Cramps are. You know, it's still three chords, but they find so many different nuances in those chords, don't they? So no matter how much that lineup fluctuates, it's always the Cramps, isn't it? And like Poison Ivy actually musically is the Cramps, isn't she? You know, so she's definitely the boss. When you used to go and see them, and she would just look at each band member across the stage, you're thinking you would not want to mess with her at all. Which, of course, we loved, you know, because in punk and post-punk and goth, the women were tough. You know, we were not the slightest bit interested in 70s, you know, the idea of a woman just being, does all the washing up type women. We were not interested in that at all. We wanted women who intellectually, physically were superior to us. You know, we wanted challenging women, and Poison Ivy, Susie, people like Ludgy Lunch, they're all like that, you know, or even like Jordan in the sex shop in London, you know, women who were kind of scary because they were smarter than you were and they were tougher. And we like that, you know, because the old gender roles are so boring. The big macho man going home and beating his wife up, that wasn't the world that we wanted to inhabit, you know. And all that period, it tore all that down, you know. It changed, and a lot of the women in goth clubs were different types of women you hadn't really seen before, you know, challenging women, women that would challenge you. We like that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. That was part of it as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this is a vinyl podcast. We talk about vinyl and collecting and that sort of thing. And with goth music and the rise and the journey of goth, do you think that the format of vinyl records played a role in that? And the reason why I ask that is, you know, just today I was listening to Joy Division on vinyl record. It seems strange for me to be able to listen to that on CD or a different way. It seems natural for me to want to listen to it on this weird black orb that I keep around the house, you know, that I use this arcane technology for. And I wanted to get your thoughts on the impact of the vinyl format on the history of goth.
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up.
Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside,
so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new.
Turn a $5 used record into a $50 functioning collectible.
Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. I wanted to get your thoughts on the impact of the vinyl format on the history of goth.
Well, I think we're still very much in the vinyl era there, aren't we? So the vinyl and the packaging and the artwork going wrap around the vinyl was very key. You know, there's a lot of great artwork, which is driven by the space you could have, because 12 and 7 inch is a lot of space to fill in with a great piece of artwork. Yeah, it was very much a vinyl kind of culture. But it's interesting you mentioned Joy Division there, because I think Martin Hannett himself would have been the first person to get that onto a CD, the first person to get it onto streaming, the first person to get to the next stage. I mean, if Martin Hannett was still alive and hadn't sort of messed himself up, he'd probably be doing gaming now, you know, because he was always... And him and Tony Wilson the same. It was always the rush for technology. They were fascinated by technology, what the next technology was. And I think, and it's interesting, you know, with Joy Division, because it was that was not a live band playing in a studio, making an analog record, going straight to vinyl. You know, the classic purist way of making a record. You know, You know, the Steve Albini thing, when Steve is the world's best recording engineer and his mic placement is absolutely genius. But Hannett was different. Hannett was about sculpting sound with effects and making sonic effects, which, so all the digital delays and the harmonizers, he was obsessed with. He invented quite a few of the digital delays that are used in studios to this day, but they never told him. He used to write to the companies and say, can you get one that does this? They'll make it and send them one. Then they stick it out in the market under a different name. He was completely ripped off, but he was so obsessed with the sound. So for Martin, I don't think when he was making them Joy Division records, I don't think he was thinking, I only want to make a record that sounds good on vinyl, full stop. He would be thinking in future terms. And if it was now, he'd probably be remixing those records to make them sound good for some technology that's not even come out yet. So, I mean, there was definitely a technological part of goth. You know, a lot of the guitar effects pedals are coming in and people were using effects. And I think maybe actually you can backtrack a little bit, and that starts with the Bowie records and the Berlin trilogy. You know, when Tony Visconti walked in with the harmonizer, it's the first time a harmonizer is using a record. And Bowie said to him, what does that do? And Tony Visconti said, it melts time. Is it? And you think, whoa, that is the effect you want, an effect that melts time. Because isn't that what every great record does? It melts time. You're in that moment forever.
Yeah.
When you listen to the tune. In the level. So at the time, it was about the future. And now it's about the past, which is kind of weird, isn't it? So, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when 7-inch single was the future. You know, the 70s, glam rock, growing up as a kid. It was all about, you didn't listen to albums, you just listened to 7-inch singles and the B-side. And vinyl was the future of music. That was the, wow, look at this, is space, this is sci-fi, you know, vinyl. But it's quite weird because we've all got older and they become antiques. And people embrace vinyl and talk about vinyl like an antique collection. You know, I have friends who collect, you know, my friend actually talked about the Cramps, owns every single Cramps record ever released and every single color of vinyl. And I just think he's completely mad. But
that's a big project.
But I understand that, you know, people like to collect things, and vinyl is perfect for that. I mean, a grandfather clock to me looks far better than an iPhone, you know, an Apple Watch. You know, it's a beautiful artifact, but you can't take it anywhere. You're going to put it in the corner of your room in the flat, you know. So it's interesting. I just think it's interesting how pop culture becomes antique as well. And we talk, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody. You know, I've just written a book about an antique culture that was once the future. You know, so what you realize in culture, that whatever seems like the future will one day be another dusty antique.
Going into this book, how was this different than some of your other books? And how did you research the history of goth and pull this story together?
I think some of the basic research is actually living it or living music, probably like you know, like 40, 45, probably nearly 50 years being immersed in this stuff. That's quite a lot of research you've already done, isn't it? Well, obviously, yeah. That's not all the research. I mean, then you interview the bands, then you talk to people, and then you endlessly talk about the subject. You read all the other books, you go around the internet. I mean, that's a great thing now. You can triple check your facts, because when I start writing books, there was no internet. So you used to have to ring up the press agent to get the spelling or something correct. And it was a very long process. Now you can look up the information. Of course, you have to double check it, because a lot of information on the internet is not 100% correct, but you can get closer to it, you know.
But you've got access to a lot of these artists throughout the book. I mean, who were some of the artists that you worked with, and what was some of the information that you were able to pull out and probably illuminate for maybe the first time in this book?
I interviewed most of these people, and I've been told of some of these people, and I knew some of these people. So I think the key to what I'm trying to explain here is I'm trying to point out that the goth is not a sneery term for a culture. This is actually one of the great art rock cultures, you know, that's incredibly influential. And some of the musical and cultural ideas that it embraced are really important. You know, it's not just people with black lipstick on. And also I wanted to sort of explain with the artists themselves who don't like the term goth. I mean, virtually every chapter I have to start off with Andrew Eldritch hates the term goth and explain why he hates the term goth. But then I sort of explain that why actually it kind of works for a lot of people, that he is kind of goth as well, you know, and how he operates completely individually, artistically, within a sort of genre, you know. Because he likes to think of himself as being a 70s rock band, but I'm thinking no 70s rock band used a drum machine. You know, they didn't have that sparseness, that minimalism, and that knowingness, because the Sister Mercy are very knowing. It's a it's a rock and roll band that's almost a pastiche of a rock and roll band. They're kind of laughing at rock and roll while being rock and roll. And I like that. I like the idea you could do two completely opposite things at the same time, and it totally makes sense, doesn't it?
The field of goth right now seems to be appearing in other media. So, for example, you know, Netflix Wednesday, you know, yeah, or some of the you know, Tim Burton movie, things like that, that are taking bits that would be considered goth culture and putting them on a very well illuminated stage. Is that healthy for goth? Is that, what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's always that thing that people want to keep things underground, but I love it when things get in the mainstream. You know, like when Nirvana broke massive, it felt like a victory, you know, and it's why can't we have great mainstream culture? You know, it's because you can always change the underground to something else. You just keep it moving. They're great ideas that should be shared with everybody. So Wednesday's kind of brought goth right back into the middle of a mainstream, into another generation, you know. And what those, you know, 12, 13-year-old kids will do with that culture as they get older, make it into something else, is quite fascinating, isn't it? I mean, at the moment, they're making little TikTok videos of them dancing to it, which is great, doing the Wednesday dance, which is cool. But, you know, when they get older, and when they're 18, 19, they'll be maybe not making bands, maybe they'll be designing computer games or something. But music, see, the thing about music is it is eternal. It's not central to the culture, but it's still everywhere all at once, isn't it? So it's not like when we were growing up, it was the only thing you could possibly do if you want to make culture art. Music was the only thing that was available and there, and it defined everything. Now it kind of soundtracks everything, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, you know. And I like the way sort of goth ideas and the feel of goth proliferates everywhere. So there is an underground goth scene. So when I was going to music events in Russia before the war, there was like amazing electronic music made by people with one laptop that was so dark, very Russian, you know, like, we're all going to die anyway, who cares, you know, which is kind of mindset. And goth is huge. The Joy Division were the biggest band in Russia. Every kid loved Joy Division, and every band was influenced by Joy Division. They could not, and I'd seen Joy Division play, and they could not understand. I'd seen Joy Division play to about 100 people. They thought Joy Division were like U2, like a stadium band. Go, no, they never got that big. It's only afterwards they got big. So musically, it sort of proliferates into electronic music. So there's bands influenced by it, and then it's gaming and film. So the culture is kind of like a lot of these cultures. They're everywhere and nowhere. So you may not see anybody dress up like a goth for weeks and ends, but then you turn on the telly. I was at my mum's the other day, and she watched a bit of telly. I don't really watch telly that much. And there was like some mainstream cop show on, and there's a Joy Division demo as part of the soundtrack of the programme in the background. I was thinking, that is so bizarre. It was like Joy Division when they were more like Warsaw, that period. And I was thinking, that couldn't even get on the radio at the time, but now it's just there. And it's all stitched into the fabric of modern culture, isn't it?
Well, and those sort of things, like Wednesday or like when Nirvana broke, those were very authentic. And I think the reasons why they worked is because we could sense that they were authentic and they were coming from a place and a community who was aware and appreciative. I think what sometimes that fear of things getting big is that there will be people who misrepresent it. There's a suspicion of those type of individuals that are using a culture for some personal gain or as some sort of badge of honor. What do you think about goth is misunderstood today?
I think people only see the surface and they don't see the depth. So like we were saying earlier, they just see it as black lipstick and black hair, which is great, but it's a very literate culture. You know, there's so much nuance and texture in the culture itself and the clothing, but also in the music. You know, the music, so it's a lot of people list the Bela Lugosi and just think it's, oh, look at that, sort of a hammy, spooky song, but it's actually a really brilliantly put together piece of art rock. You know, the guitar playing by Daniel Ash is mind-blowing. I mean, he never plays anything cliched. He makes kind of weird, cool sounds of the guitar that are musical. And they're easy to do now, but really hard to come up with. Nobody came up with that before. And that's an art form. And that's what I was trying to explain in the book, that there is an art to the darkness, you know, literally, you know, it wasn't trashy, you know, even when it embraced trash, it did it in a very artful kind of way as well. And I think when things do get watered down, go mainstream, they never quite get it right. But that doesn't affect the core culture, which just carries on anyway, you know. And also, I think it's good that when you get a next generation reinterpreting it on their own terms, you know, their own cultures. They grew up with different things. They didn't grow up in the 70s watching Top of the Pops once a week, waiting for David Bowie to appear. They were doing gaming. They were on TikTok, you know, with music. You know, like kids now, they don't even use a MacBook. It's too big for them. It's like on a phone with about six different things going on at the same time. It's part of one of those things. It's part of the soundtrack. Or there's a little dark little TikTok video in the corner. So it's in there, but in a different kind of way. Then they will reinterpret that out in another different way again. They may just go back to forming bands. I think it's quite funny that a lot of modern young goths call the older bands trad goth. I think that's such a great term, isn't it?
Trad goth? What's the trad stand for?
Well, traditional, you know, like trad jazz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, okay. So Bauhaus or Sisters would be looked on as trad goth bands, you know. And they love them. They're classic, you know. And there's been a revival in those bands as well, you know. So, because for quite a long time, goth went on its own journey. It's got this modern goth bands as well, you know, mm-hmm. a modern sort of dark. And a lot of goth clubs you go to in Europe for years would play very dark electronic music, like dark goth techno, where you wouldn't really know who made it, just a seamless hole of darkness. But then There's a bit of a revival in the trad goth bands as well. So things always come back round in culture, don't they? Because everything's present, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I know my obsession about records and record collecting. I'm well aware that that is me just trying to capture a bit of my childhood in a bottle, you know, and I'm chasing those goosebumps that I had when I was a kid and record shopping with my dad and different things like that. And what music and what records meant to me then is kind of the thing that I'm chasing now. I'm looking for those new experiences and things. And I've also got no doubt that all the records behind me that, you know, I've paid up $10,000 for will in 100 years probably be in a landfill because no one will have that appreciation for it. Very few people think will.
I don't agree because I think – because he's
at you don't? Answers.
No, I think they go up in value. I've got a friend who deals in records and he's got one of the copies of Anarchy in the UK. He ain't selling that. He's waiting for it to go up to 50,000 quid. Because it will go up. So they are antiques. It's like antique paintings, you know. It's not a way of looking at music as an investment, but it actually is an investment. I mean, you're buying them because you love them, and that's a great reason. And I understand that as well. I remember like buying a record as a kid was a portal, wasn't it? This was the portal to outer space. You know, the new T-Rex record was like so magical. You could hear it on the radio, but actually holding it in your hand and playing it was an amazing thing, you know. And it's like you had a tiny portion of that world. That was your own in the crap town you were growing up in. That was your part of pop culture. You owned a tiny bit of it, and I understand all that. And when records, initially they didn't even come in record in sleeves. Picture sleeves didn't even come into punk. But when the punk days, when they had sleeves, that was even more. You know, it's a whole package of something. You know, and it's so. I totally have that feeling, you know, as well, you know. But I can actually also get it from putting headphones on and listen to a piece of music online as well. I can get so immersed in it. It's not a thing you can hold or anything, but the music is everything for me. So I get lost completely in the music.
Do you have a bit of a record collection? Do you like physical form media?
I still have records. I mean, I've still got about 200 or 300. I mean, I used to have thousands, but I only live in a little flat, and I just had to climb over them to get in the room. So I got into minimalism. I thought, well, I can actually hear all this stuff anyway on my laptop, or and I'm never at home, so I'm always out and about. So usually for me, it's a phone and headphones because I'm touring a lot, I'm traveling a lot. So there's no point in having a place that I live that was full of stuff, you know. So But no matter how much I try and get rid of it, it just keeps breeding.
But I would imagine from your history and just being the places you are. And by the way, John, I'd love to have you back and we'll talk. I know we talked all about goth today, but I'd love to have you back and talk about your musical history and the places you've been and the stories you've had, because absolutely fascinating. But you must have collected some artifacts from those individuals, from those times that you still have, some of the very precious, I guess, items and objects that are in your record collection. Do you have any of those you could share or talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I do have some really rare records. You know, I've got Nirvana's first single, the first edition of it. I've got Oasis's first white label, because I've been a music writer, so people give you stuff, you know, as well. So yeah, quite a few like rare punk records. I mean, they're not in great condition though, because I had no idea at the time this stuff was going to be worth money. Because I didn't, even though I'm massively into my history, I never thought the culture I was in would become history. Because you don't, do you? Because the great thing about pop culture was, especially in the old days, it was about the moment, and the moment went, and you got on to the next moment. Whereas now, it has become a history. So a lot of those records are scratched, all the sleeves are missing. Like, with a Nirvana single, because I made it single of the week in Sounds when I was writing for it, I sent them the sleeve because they needed some artwork because they didn't have a picture of the band. I never got the sleeve back, so it's just the single, the big scratch on it now.
That was the Love Buzz?
I thought it was an amazing record. I remember I heard a cassette of it first because there was a cassette knocking about. My mate had it in a record shop before it came out, and they put it on, and they're all going, ooh, Sub Pop have ruined it. You know, Mudhoney's a band, and this is the worst thing they signed. And Mudhoney, I love Mudhoney, of course. But I was the only one in that shop going, oh my God, this is totally genius. Have you heard his voice? It just sent shivers up my spine. I thought he's the most amazing singer. He sounded like a young old man. He sounded like an old blues singer and a kid at the same time. He sounded desperate. I had no idea that he actually was a young old man who was desperate. I just heard his voice. And it was the scouring greatness of it and the intensity of it just blew me away. And I always loved Love Buzz anyway. I like the original of it, you know. So I totally got it. It's a weird track to do as your first single, isn't it? It's quite knowing. You'd have to know your pop culture to even find that track to cover it when you're like an 18-year-old kid. Yeah.
It makes a hell of a statement. So, you know, and there's an interview that you had with Nirvana, the Bleach era Nirvana. And you can find that, people can find that online. By the way,
YouTube, yeah, that was the second interview. I'd interviewed him after I heard that demo. I phoned him up at his mum's house and interviewed him. It's his first ever interview, and it's one of those classic first ever interviews. Like, you go, so where'd you get the name of the band from? I don't know anything about him, right? There's no even a press release. I'm just ringing up this kid in Washington State in Aberdeen, trying to work out who he is and how he made this record. I mean, what do you ask? There's no backstory. I can't Google any information. Who's in your band? What was it like at school? I mean, it was those crap questions because there was nothing else to know. It was like I just met him on the phone. And then 6 months later, we went out to New York and we stayed with him for 4 days in a flat because it sounds, when I wrote for, they never got us hotels. We always had to stay with the band, which actually now was the best thing because I got to know Nirvana really well. So I was carrying their gear for them up and down the steps. I helped them with the gear because I'm in a band, so I don't mind lugging gear. I remember when I went out to do Fugazi in Italy, and they were going, we don't do interviews. And I go, oh. And then they knew who I was because of the membranes. And we all know each other in underground bands. And then at the gig, he broke a string on his guitar, so I strung his guitar up for him and stuff. So then they did the interview because they realised, because at the time, music journalists were snidey, weren't they? It was all about trying to get one over the band, trying to make the bands look stupid. Well, I was never into that because I was in a band and also because I'm a fan and I'm into the culture. You know, when I interview a band, it's because I really love the band. I wouldn't go and interview a band I didn't like. I mean, I know people are good at all that and tripping the band up, but it doesn't interest me. I haven't got time. I haven't got time to go interview Coldplay and make an idiot out of Chris Martin or whatever. What's the point? I can go find a new band in Manchester and fall in love with them. That's what I'm into. Yeah. Mm.
So who are some of the new bands that we should be paying attention to?
Oh, there's a lot of really good bands. There's a new band called Meryl Streak, everyone's buzzing about in England. They're really good. There's a great old girl band in Manchester called Fever, who's like a rocked-up version of the early Birthday Party. There's so much. I mean, that's one of the great things about doing a site. You're always right about finding new stuff. You know, there's always people sending you stuff all the time. In fact, I feel sorry for new bands now because there's more bands now than ever has been. I think it's like when I started in bands, there's about 20 bands in Manchester. Now there's 20 bands in every street. Everybody's in a band. And so the slices of the cake are really tiny. And how do you ever even get heard? I mean, I try to listen to stuff. I can't. Even one day, I couldn't listen to all the stuff I get sent. It's impossible.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very hopeful because I hear a lot of new bands, especially a lot of them that are coming out of Australia at this point. I've always thought that, you know, hard times make good art. And we just came off the back of 2 or 3 years that were pretty shattering to a lot of people. And I'm starting to hear the results in music. And at least that's a silver lining of what humanity's had to go through the last few years.
Yeah.
Look, and John, just watching what you do, especially with Louder Than War and the platforms that you built for yourself, and people listening to this who aren't as familiar with John's work, Google him up. You can see him on TED Talks. You can see him out there putting himself out there and really kind of doing the work to further the culture. So, look, again, John, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guy.
Oh, thanks.
I really do appreciate it. No. I'm going to be putting some links to John's book, The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth, in this episode page. You can go to membranes.bandcamp.com. Of course, go to louderthanwar.com, where John is the founder and editor-in-chief. Again, John, thank you so much for coming on the show. And we want to have you back, and we're going to talk, we're going to deep dive into Membranes and Goldblade and all sorts of other musical nooks and crannies.
Brilliant. Really enjoyed that. Thanks a lot.
Man, is he fascinating. I definitely have to have John back at some point. And again, The History of Goth, there's autographed copies at louderthanwar.com. And don't forget, there's an extended version of this interview at patreon.com/vinylguide. If you want to know what to get me for Christmas or my birthday, or you just enjoy the Vinyl Guide podcast and want to do me a solid, well, head up there now. Help support the show, $5 or $10 a month. That really makes me smile, and you get a bunch of extras, including an extended version of this interview with John and lots more. Patreon.com/vinylguide, and thanks in advance for your support. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please leave us positive reviews on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Log in there, give us 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something nice. That always helps the podcast. Huge help, actually. Don't forget to share these podcasts with your friends. Show them how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. It's not always obvious to everyone. So if you got a record nerd friend and they're not listening to the Vinyl Guide podcast, well, help them work it out on their phone and they will thank you for it. And so will I. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.